delighted to see our usual crowd here today for this case, but we do have some special guests. We have with us Mr. Kouri, who is on the legislative staff in Mali. Welcome. And we have Jean-Baptiste Zadig, who is with the legislative staff and attorney at law at the Ivory Coast. I wish to welcome you both to an oral argument. Thank you. The afternoon case is 97-0270, Warner Jackson versus John Benson. We have a number of attorneys arguing on both sides of this issue, and I have a sheet before me that has divided out the 1 hour into a variety of segments. The court will be lenient, although the red light will go on. The court will be lenient on extending time, although we also plan to adjourn in time to handle all the cases we've heard today. So I'll try and be fair on both sides of this. Any objection to that? Okay. So we are first going to hear from the counsel representing Mr. Benson. Mr. Marion, you have a statement?
Good afternoon, Your Honor. May it please the court. It's my pleasure to introduce Attorney Jay Lefkowitz from the state of Maryland and Attorney Richard Hutchison from the state of Missouri, who will be arguing respectively the following issues. Article 1, Section 18 of the Wisconsin Constitution, Mr. Lefkowitz, as well as the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment, and Mr. Hutchison will address the court with leave of court regarding the Free Exercise Clause of the First Amendment.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you. And those motions had already been accepted, Mr. Marion. But they be recognized to put Pia Pro Hic Vici.
I would make that request at this time. Thank you.
Counsel, your request is granted. Mr. Lefkowitz, I show you for 13 whole minutes.
Chief Justice Abrahamson, and may it please the court. For more than a decade, the legislature has been working to find a solution to the educational crisis that this court first noted in 1992 in Davis v. Grover. And the 1995 amendments to the choice plan, which are the subject of this appeal, are a continuation of those efforts by the legislature and were carefully crafted in order to survive the kind of constitutional challenges that have been mounted here. This afternoon, I would like to highlight the factors most important to the religion clause issues in this case. Most importantly, I believe that the guiding legal principles under both the state and the federal constitutions, Article 1, Section 18, and the First Amendment Establishment Clause, have not changed since we were here 2 years ago on original jurisdiction. Wisconsin law has an unbroken string of precedents spanning more than three decades, holding that the goals of Article 1, Section 18, and the goals of the Establishment Clause are consistent, and that even though the two phrases, the two words, the two provisions are not identical, and indeed, Article 1, Section 18 has additional language which sometimes has been referred to as terser, sometimes more prohibitive, this Court has made clear on many occasions that the words are not so prohibitive so as not to encompass the primary effects test. Now, this is not to suggest, Your Honors, in any way that this Court should not analyze the choice plan under its own constitution. In Miller, Justice Geske, writing for the entire Court, made clear that Article 1, Section 18 and the Establishment Clause are not strict equivalents. But Miller did not purport to overrule King or any of the other cases in which the court has said we continue to look to the federal primary effects test. Nor did this court hold that its religion jurisprudence would not be informed by federal precedents. To the contrary, in Miller, this court went on to state that it would continue to seek guidance from federal precedents, and indeed, in the case at bar in Miller, the court resolved the matter by looking to a time-honored federal precedent, the compelling state interest, least restrictive alternative test. Under the precedents, Your Honors, of this court as well as the United States Supreme Court, the most important safeguards of constitutionality in religious benefits cases are neutrality and indirection.
Let me interrupt you for one moment. And I don't know how you and other counsel divided out your subjects, but I'm looking at the curriculum that this court issued in March of 1996 in the original actions. Okay?
Yes.
And in footnote 1, three justices would have held that it was unconstitutional under the Wisconsin Constitution. And footnote 2, it says that three justices believe that while the legislature has chosen to expand the program in the amendments challenged here, the program is still limited and experimental. Do you treat this as experimental and limited? Because you seem to, in your introductory comments, indicate it's viewed to help the crisis in the court system.
Your Honor, I would presume that the program is still experimental. It is an expansion of the original choice plan. I don't think, though, Your Honor, that with respect to the Article 1, Section 18, or the Establishment Clause jurisprudence, that it would be an issue one way or the other.
Doesn't matter to you. It could cover the whole state, and it would be constitutional in your... Yeah.
With respect to the religion clause issues, yes,
okay.
Your Honor.
With respect to what other issue isn't it?
Well, I don't know, Your Honor, whether it would be an issue at all under any of the non-religion clauses. I believe Mr. Bolick will be addressing those. But we believe, in any event, that the program here is continuation of the experiment in educational reform that the state legislature has been pursuing for a couple of decades now.
Well, now I hear two things. Is it your position that this is valid even if it's not experimental and it covered the whole state and covered everybody?
My position, Your Honor, is that with respect to the issues that I am addressing, it is absolutely constitutional under the religion grounds.
Okay.
My question is this, is you talk about Salerno and the fact that, and I want to know how serious you are because the Chief Justice mentioned that we looked at this in 1996, now back in 98. If I understand your argument under Salerno, you're asking this court to perhaps wait for an as-applied challenge. In other words, does this mean that we're going to put this on the back burner, let the program go into effect, and then wait and see what happens, and then have it come back up here?
Well, under the rule set by the United States Supreme Court in Salerno, which is a very, very rigid rule, but is nonetheless the rule that they have adopted, a program in a facial challenge cannot be struck down if there is even one set of circumstances under which it would be constitutional. But, Your Honor, I think this court has its own very well-developed jurisprudence with respect to the presumption of constitutionality, and indeed in religion cases itself, in unanimous opinions by this court, in Nussbaum 2 in 1974 and in Holt versus Thompson in 1975, the court specifically looked at facial challenges and said, we're not going to strike the statute down based on this hypothetical or this application because the challenge is to the statute on its face. I think the Salerno rule is a very, very strong rule, but I think it's frankly informed by the same principles of presumption of constitutionality that this court has many, many times adopted and enforced. Under the principles and the precedents of this court, as well as the Supreme Court, if you have neutrality and indirection, those are the two most important safeguards. Neutrality is obviously important because it protects a program, it protects the state from directly funneling money to a religious institution. One of the cases that the opponents rely heavily on under this court's jurisprudence is Reynolds, the 1962 school bus busing program, and this court in 1969 in Reuter made very clear that Reynolds was in fact an application of the federal primary effects test, but indeed this court acknowledged that in effect all of the benefits under the Reynolds program flowed to parochial schools. There were no benefits that flowed outside of the religious arena. That's the important principle of neutrality. The important principle of indirection is equally important because it establishes that but for the acts of individual citizens, not state actors, No money flows to the benefit of religious institutions. The state is not the faucet, so to speak. It is an individual making a choice.
Doesn't school get more than it might pay for tuition ordinarily?
Under the stipulated facts here, a number of the schools that are eligible for the choice program have tuitions which are very much below their actual costs. They're subsidized. And so it seems to me, Your Honor, that when we look at what constitutes a benefit with respect to a market that's not an efficient market, it's a matter of not letting these schools perhaps make some kind of a profit. To not require them to continue to operate at a loss is not, I believe, the level where a benefit would come in. So I don't believe that simply by allowing the schools who are going to be eligible in the program to recoup their actual cost for the additional education to these students would be a problem under the neutrality or the indirection principles of either this court or the Supreme Court.
So there's no line we should draw as far as the money going in, as far as the tuition? Do we have to draw a line there and say it's only for actual expense?
Well, I would say, Your Honor, that and this raises an issue that Judge Rogensack raised in her dissent below. I think there's no question that the principles set by this court all the way back in the Atwood case, which predated even the time that the First Amendment applied to the state, clearly sets a floor that the cost of educating the students is not a problem. Now, if there's an issue as to the marginal cost or an issue as to the average cost, seems to me that the way we have to look at the program now is to make sure that these parochial schools or these sectarian schools are not able to actually make a profit. To make sure that they're not required to continue to lose money, I don't think the Constitution compels a program where schools have to continue to lose money. I would point out, though, Your Honor, that while I don't believe that Judge Rogensack's interpretation of this statutory language here is necessary, because I think the Constitution permits us to go beyond that as long as there's no actual benefit, I think what she did is actually very accurate in terms of indulging the presumption of constitutionality.
Counsel, I have a difficult time squaring your concept of neutrality with the agreed statement and agreement between the parties. This is agreed to, that the law does not prohibit any of the religious schools that get this money from using this money for the salaries of people that are associated with their religious mission. It does not prohibit them from using these public tax dollars for literature and other material associated with their religious mission. Now, that's agreed to by all the parties. How does that square with neutral?
Your Honor, this court, going back to the Nussbaum 1 case, made it clear that the kind of segregation of funding for non-religious activities is an important principle when there is not a neutral statute. That was a sole source contract with Marquette Dental School. Here, when you have a statute that allocates the money neutrally and also the benefits only flow indirectly, the fact that the program may be pervasively sectarian, certainly none of the schools here are any more sectarian than the Inland School of the Bible that Mr. Witters attended, or the South Point Catholic High School that Mr. Zobrist attended in those two cases. And indeed, Your Honor, if you look back at the Atwood case, there's absolutely no issue in terms of any inquiry as to whether the benefit could be used by those religious schools that plainly benefited under the Atwood program for a religious activity or not. And of course, I think what Atwood spoke to is this notion of indirection and neutrality. Your Honor,
as to the direction, we read a lot lately about people using words very, very literally, but are nevertheless misleading. Now, you say that this is not direct because it goes from A to B and then to C. But if you're going to give money to the Chief Justice Abramson to give to me and no other, and she gives it to me, it may not be direct, but nevertheless I receive it.
Your Honor, if I were to give money to Chief Justice Abramson and tell her that she had to give the money to you, she had no choice in the matter, that might really just be a kind of sham for me to get money to you through a different vehicle. If with all due respect. But what we're really dealing with here is a situation where not one penny really flows to any private sectarian school under the choice program, but for a freely made decision by the parents. The way DPI allocates the funding to the public schools, indeed, the public schools, the money that flows to the public schools, the money that would ultimately flow through the parents to a parochial school or a non-sectarian school, is solely the result of the individual choices, and they are choices that these parents are free to make. So I think that while I understand the point that indirection could be a ruse, I don't think there's any legitimate contention here that it is a ruse. Your Honor, with a proper regard for the presumption of constitutionality, this plan passes muster. The plan does not discriminate for or against any religious sect or for or against religion generally, and no money flows without the independent choice of the parents and the children in the relevant school district.
Thank you, Mr. Lefkowitz. Mr. Hutchinson, representing Landmark Legal Foundation of Kansas City.
May it please the court, I'm here today on behalf of the Miller defendants in this matter. In determining how this court will read Article 1, Section 18's Establishment Clause in this case, the court's inquiry must not exclude consideration of the federal Constitution's First Amendment Free Exercise Clause guarantees. Largely ignored by the Circuit Court and the Court of Appeals below, the Miller defendants' free exercise claim is an important part of the constitutional issue mix presented in this case. While Article 1, Section 18 may be read by this court more or less restrictively than its federal constitutional counterpart, it cannot be so to a degree that infringes on the United States Constitution's First Amendment Free Exercise Clause guarantee. The amended MPCP cured a constitutional defect in the original choice program, and that is the impermissible, purposeful, and unconstitutional discrimination against those who would qualify for the program and for religious reasons, among others, wish to have access to religious schools. It is not access to religious schools that makes the Milwaukee Parental Choice Program unconstitutional. It is access to religious schools that makes it constitutional.
Mr. Hutchinson, do you have any authority from Wisconsin to support your proposition in that regard?
Well, the cases that we cite and that the proposition that we put forth relies on the federal free exercise clause case law. There's not Wisconsin constitutional law on point that would talk about an infringement of free exercise clause rights here on the state level. But there is a lot of case law out there it's a really old case from 1814. But going up through Widmar versus Benson, that says that the Supremacy Clause does come into play, and where a federal constitutional right is compromised under a state law or a state constitutional provision, the federal constitutional right takes precedent. And that's also in the federal constitution under the Supremacy Clause.
However, your federal cases don't come up on all fours, do they, with the situation we're faced with here?
No, it does not. It could. However, the reason we're in this case is that the original program, we felt, specifically, violated a fundamental constitutional right of religious people who wanted to apply, who qualified for the program and wanted to apply their benefit using their religious considerations. We brought litigation on that principle. And we are in this case because the amendment to the program cured that constitutional defect. Now, if the amendments are not upheld, then the constitutional defect is back in place. And so that is our interest in the case. I would conclude my 2 minutes with pointing out this court's analysis does not require an analysis of burden on religion and whether or not this the program prior to the amendments places some additional burden on the Miller defendants. The correct test is that the government may not discriminate against religious activity or impose special disabilities on it. It has to be neutral and of general applicability, and that's what the amendments to the plan provide. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hutchison. Mr. Hurley, Attorney Hurley.
May it please the court, I'm Stephen Hurley of Madison. It's my honor to introduce to you Mr. Clint Bullock of the District of Columbia and California Bars. He represents the appellant's parents for school choice. He will argue to you the state constitutional issues other than those dealing with the establishment of religion, and I move his admission pro hac vice.
Motion's granted, Mr. Hurley. Mr. Bullock, welcome back to Madison.
Thank you. It is always a pleasure to be here, and it is an honor to be here before this court once again on this important issue. And thank you for granting my motion. There has not been a lot of good news coming out of the Milwaukee Public Schools over this decade. Only this past week, the state's first results from its new tests have revealed that fewer than 10% of the youngsters in the Milwaukee public schools in 8th and 10th grade are proficient in language arts and in mathematics. So it is little wonder that in 1995, the legislature decided to expand a program that seemed to be doing a good job, particularly with the kids who often have the most difficulties in their education. The Milwaukee Parental Choice Program is not a perfect program, but it does provide a vehicle within which the hopes and opportunities of thousands of economically disadvantaged children resonate. Now, the plaintiffs repeatedly invoke the mantra that this case is not the forum in which to argue about public policy, and perhaps on only this occasion, I agree with the plaintiffs on that point. The public policy was debated before the legislature, and the plaintiffs were unsuccessful in that forum. But the context in which this program was expanded and in which it operates is vital to resolving the state constitutional issues of uniformity, public purpose, and private or local bill. This court in 1989 in Cooker versus Grover admonished the legislature to direct its attention to the needs of overburdened school districts, and it has done so repeatedly. It most recently has enacted charter schools. It has maintained magnet schools. The Chapter 220 inter-district transfer program, post-secondary enrollment options, this program, at-risk placements of children in private schools. All of those programs, or some of them, share certain common denominators. In all of them, the funding that the state provides for children follows the child to the educational alternative that that child goes to. In none of those instances is the education provided to the children rigidly uniform. In fact, the whole point of all of those programs is that ordinary district schools are not necessarily appropriate for all children. Many of the programs are specifically addressed to Milwaukee, and many of the programs involve private entities. Private entities, for example, can sponsor charter schools. You can attend post-secondary schools that are private and religious. At-risk placements take place in private schools. The reading of the uniformity clause urged upon this court by the plaintiffs would imperil all of those programs for one or both of two reasons. First of all, the schools are not all rigidly uniform. And second of all, in many of the schools, they are private entities, or they are operated by private entities. In essence, the reading urged upon this court by the plaintiffs would transform Article 10, Section 3 from a foundation into a straitjacket. And certainly that was not the purpose of the uniformity clause.
Counsel, I'm going to ask you the same question I asked Mr. Lefkowitz. Is this still an experimental program? And is your argument about uniformity, public purpose, et cetera, is it Would it matter if this program covered the entire state?
In Davis versus Grover, this court focused in part under Article 4, Section 18, the private or local bill issue, in particular on the experimental nature of the program. The court gave two reasons for upholding the program under the private or local bill. First of all, that the program empowered low-income parents to choose educational opportunities, thus engendering educational success competition between the public and private educational sectors. Certainly that remains the case now with the expanded program, in fact, even more so. But the second point that the court recognized in Davis and in the court's per curiam decision in 1995 in this case, that the experimental nature of the program was a factor. This program remains experimental. It is a logical second step in an ongoing experiment. The program has been enlarged from 1,500 to 15,000 kids, a large expansion relative to the initial population, but still limited to 15% of the kids, and of course limited to the Milwaukee public school system, which of course the legislature has recognized not only in this program, but by devoting an entire chapter of the state statutes to the special needs of Milwaukee, that Milwaukee continues to have unique needs in that regard.
But if this program were expanded to the state, what would your argument be?
Your Honor, if this program was enacted statewide within the context of a budget bill, there would not be a problem if it was whether it was experimental or not, because it would not be limited to a specific jurisdiction. With regard to other constitutional issues, it depends on how the plan were structured. But here, I think that you don't have uniformity clause problems in particular. In large part, I think that the concerns that you expressed, Chief Justice Abrahamson, in Davis are very important concerns, and one that this court should not take lightly within the uniformity clause issue. However, I think that what the court ought to do in determining whether there is a uniformity violation is not to say, no, you can't have these alternatives, but rather look at whether the state has in fact abandoned its obligation toward the public schools. And here, the evidence in the record today is better than the evidence was in the record on that point, because we had an evidentiary hearing that dealt in part with these very issues. Dr. Fuller testified. John Gardner, the chairman of the Finance Committee for the Milwaukee School Board, testified. They've also, by the way, put together an important amicus brief in this case. The total aid to the Milwaukee public schools between 1990 and 1996 increased by 65%. The share of the Milwaukee public school budget that is provided by the state during that same period increased from 56 to 67%. This is in the Gardner affidavit. There was also testimony that this program has helped the Milwaukee public schools relieve overcrowding. It has avoided the necessity of capital expenditures. And it has, of course, had the competitive effect that has spurred needed reform within the Milwaukee public schools. So, Your Honor, I think with regard to the uniformity clause, what this court ought to do in terms of trying to figure out whether there is a violation is not to forbid alternatives like at-risk placements, like this program, but rather to see whether the state has, in fact, honored its commitment of providing access to district schools that are, in fact, high quality. And the evidence in the record on this point is absolute. There is no evidence that the state's commitment to the Milwaukee public schools has declined. On the contrary, this program is one part of a very large and aggressive effort to rescue the kids in the Milwaukee public school system and to improve the educational offerings both within the district schools and over and above that. Your Honor, with respect to the public purpose doctrine, just a brief comment there. There are a number of, the legislature of course had 5 years of experience with this program before expanding it. It eliminated some protections, and maintained others, including, and one of the things that the Court of Appeals overlooked was a provision in the program, section 119.237B, where the superintendent continues to monitor performance of students in the schools. But the Legislative Audit Bureau continues to perform financial and performance audits. There is an annual financial audit that the schools themselves have to go through. And, of course, there remains the fact that it is, and this is to get to a point that was raised with Mr. Lefkowitz, no money changes hands in this program unless a parent has made two decisions. First of all, to apply for the program, and second of all, to direct that funding to a particular school. And that not only goes to the religion issue, but to the public purpose doctrine issue as well. The courts below, the trial court grafted onto the public purpose doctrine a religious limitation, which we believe is dealt with more appropriately within Articles 1, Section 18. I see that my time has expired, so I will conclude simply by saying this. The plaintiffs face a very enormous burden in finding any aspect of the Wisconsin Constitution that would compel this court to deny children educational opportunities they desperately need. These kids may not have a second chance. Thank you.
Mr. Bullock?
Yes.
I have this correct. There's very limited supervision under this bill of these private schools. Is that correct?
Your Honor, on the one hand, this program seeks to allow private schools to do what they do best, which is to educate without the heavy hand of government. And this court has recognized repeatedly that the public purpose doctrine does not require heavy-fisted government regulation. But it does do what this court has insisted that such programs do, and that is to apply such regulations as the legislature deems appropriate, and that is, again, the schools have to do financial audits every year.
What about educational?
With regard to
prescribe what courses to take and how many hours?
Your Honor, Section 118.165 of the Wisconsin statutes, which applies to all private schools, requires a basic sequential curriculum. All of the kids are learning the things that the state has deemed necessary and appropriate for children to learn. Also, the superintendent retains authority to perform a performance audit of the program, as well as the Legislative Audit Bureau, which will be issuing its performance audit as well. But in terms of educational quality, Your Honor, it is the philosophy of this program, and one that I think it's within the legislature's purview to do, to say that the parents have the greatest incentive, and the parents, we can trust the parents. And again, the regulations were adopted within this expansion after 5 years of experience with the program.
If one of these schools closes during the school year, what happens with the student and the money?
Your Honor, because of Article 10, Section 3, every child must have access to a district school education. If a school closes during the year, then that child has the right to return to a district school or to go to a different choice school if there is room in that choice school and the parent opts to send the child
there. Does the state pay again?
The payments are made in segments. If a school owes money back to the state, then presumably the state would have an action against that school to recover the money. But the state remains, there's no instance in which the state does not remain responsible for providing an education to that child.
Including a second payment for private school.
That would be a matter of recovering money from the private school, Your Honor. But if that's what it takes, that's what it takes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Wallach, if I might ask you a question also. The DPI annual evaluation that was in the earlier legislation was eliminated by the amendments in this program. Why do you think that was done?
Your Honor, the superintendent continues to have the authority to monitor the performance of the program, but you're absolutely right, Justice Crooks, the annual report was eliminated. I would have to speculate, but one of the things that came out during the evidentiary testimony in this case was that the state had chosen a single researcher who had not been willing to release the data to others to examine that data afresh. And in fact, Dr. Paul Peterson was an expert witness at the evidentiary hearing, and he finally did have access to the data. It's been interesting that there has been more examination of this program since the department stopped doing its annual report than prior to that time. It is one of the most studied educational experiments in the United States, and I suspect that that will remain the case. But I think that the legislature, after 4 years of experience, seeing the high parental satisfaction, seeing the high parental involvement in the program, thought, we don't have to do this every single year. It's going to be studied no matter what we do, and so far, that has been the case.
Thank you, Counsel. I have here both you and Mr. Lefkowitz a five-minute rebuttal. For defending the appellant, Warner Jackson, Jeffrey Cassell. Mr. Cassell.
Thank you, Your Honor, and if it pleases the Court, if I may begin by introducing my co-counsel, who will be sharing our argument time. To my immediate left is James Hall of Milwaukee, representing the NAACP plaintiffs, and also at counsel table is Robert Channon of the District of Columbia Bar, representing the NTEA plaintiffs. Mr. Channon, I believe, was admitted pro hac vice in the circuit court, would request permission that he be allowed to argue today on behalf of the NTEA.
It's granted, Mr. Castle.
Also, before I begin the argument, I'd like to give a brief outline of how Mr. Channon and Mr. Hall and I will divide our argument. Consistent with our belief and the conclusions of the trial court and the Court of Appeals, that this case can and should be decided on the basis of Wisconsin law, I will focus first on Article 1, Section 18 of the Wisconsin Constitution, to be followed then by Mr. Hall's discussion of the Education Article, Article 10. Mr. Channon will then discuss the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment. Because of time constraints, we will rely on the MTEA and NAACP briefs for the discussion of the other important constitutional issues in this case. To uphold the constitutionality of the choice program, this court would have to conclude that Article 1, Section 18 of the Wisconsin Constitution does not mean what it says. Article 1, Section 18 expressly prohibits the use of state money for the benefit of religious organizations or religious schools. Under the choice program, literally tens of millions of dollars of state money will be transferred from the state treasury to religious schools to pay for a religious education for thousands of pupils.
Mr. Castle, the language of Article 1, Section 18 talks about religious seminaries, does it not?
Yes, it does, Your Honor.
Did you have any success, any more success than our chambers had, in looking at the history of that particular provision in light of what the drafters meant in 1848?
I have not found any original sources. I do know that this court concluded in Reynolds, the 1962 school busing case, that parochial
schools. Reynolds relied on Weiss, and Weiss, the opinion as to what that meant is in a concurring opinion. But I'm concerned with what did the drafters have in mind in 1848.
I don't have any information, but I would say even if the language with regard to religious seminaries were not in the Constitution, the language dealing with religious, I believe, some terms of religious societies still would apply because the religious schools, the parochial schools, are operated by religious societies. For over 100 years, beginning with its 1890 decision in Weiss, continuing with its 1962 decision in Reynolds, and most recently, just 2 years ago, in State v. Miller, this court has consistently held that the Wisconsin Constitution provides a more complete separation of government and religion than the federal Constitution or the constitutions of other states. In Weiss, this court noted that the purpose of the framers was to attract to this state a religiously diverse group of immigrants, immigrants who came from countries with established religions, who had suffered the consequences of their own rejection of the established state religion. To further Wisconsin's policy of encouraging immigration by all religious groups, the framers crafted a constitution that furnishes the most extensive guarantees of religious liberty, both in terms of freedom of conscience and also in terms of the non-establishment of religion. The framers had before them the federal model, which speaks in general terms about the establishment of religion, but they expressly rejected that language in favor of constitutional language that explicitly prohibits the use of state funds to benefit religious organizations.
Seminaries. You still haven't explained the word seminaries. You've switched to organization.
Well, the Constitution speaks in terms of religious societies, which I think is equivalent to a religious organization. Also, in terms of the prohibition, it clearly applies to religious seminaries, which this court held in Reynolds includes parochial schools. The state argues, in effect, that this court should ignore all that. The state argues that the court should find the meaning of Article 1, Section 18, not in Wisconsin's unique history and traditions, not in the 100-plus years of case law interpreting our Constitution, but in the recent decisions of the U.S. Supreme Court interpreting the Federal Establishment Clause. Those cases, the state argues, establishes the principles by which the choice program is to be judged under the Wisconsin Constitution. We disagree, of course, with the state's contention that the choice program is constitutional under the Supreme Court's First Amendment analysis, as Mr. Channon will discuss. But even if the Supreme Court's recent 5-4 decisions somehow signal a sea change in federal establishment clause analysis, that cannot alter the meaning of the Wisconsin Constitution. If First Amendment law has radically changed somehow in the last 15 years, that is all the more reason that the court should reject the state's suggestion that this court's analysis of our state constitution should march in lockstep with the federal analysis. It is all the more reason that this court should reaffirm what it said just 2 years ago in the Miller case, that the interpretation of our state constitution is not constrained by the boundaries of the protection the United States Supreme Court has set for the federal provision. We have heard much from the state about the principles it derives from those U.S. Supreme Court decisions, neutrality, indirection, and so on. The analysis that this court has applied under Article 1, Section 18 does not rely on these abstractions. Instead, it focuses on specific facts of the program. And the dispositive question in cases such as this, in which the money flows from the public treasury to a religious institution or a religious school, is simply this. Will those public funds be used by the religious institution for a religious purpose? If they will, the program provides an unconstitutional benefit to the religious organization.
Well, counsel, what about the argument that we've heard that it really doesn't go to the parochial schools or religious schools? It goes to the parent. The parent then can choose what school the child will go to. Some are going to choose sectarian, others non-sectarian. It's really the choice of the parents.
Well, we hear several arguments by the state. The state even says in its brief, well, the schools get no money until the parent decides to sign the check. Of course, the statute says the check is sent to the school where the parent has to sign it. So
how do they get to the school?
The DPI, by statute, must send it to the school.
I know, but then the parent has to say, send the check
to
the school.
But we are operating in a system in which the parental choice is constrained by a reality that 85% of the available seats are religious schools. So I want to make it clear, I think our position would be the same if the percentages were reversed. We don't believe that if only 15% of the seats were in parochial schools, it would be any more permissible under the state constitution. But in fact, just as the Ohio Court of Appeals observed in its recent decision in the Cleveland voucher program, the universe of choices is highly constrained. And when the legislature expanded this program, it did so because the seats available in the non-sectarian schools were filled. There was no more room. When it expanded tenfold from 1,500 students to 15,000, it knew that those seats would become available in the parochial schools.
Mr. Castle, in interpreting Article 1, Section 18, you're not suggesting, are you, that we should ignore the federal case law?
No, of course not, Your Honor.
I'm just thinking in terms of the King versus Wanneke decision and the Warren versus Nussbaum decision, where this court said that we should look to those federal cases in interpreting those provisions in Article 1, Section 18.
And certainly any governmental program, any governmental funding that violated the Establishment Clause would necessarily also violate Wisconsin Constitution. So certainly, if a question could be answered that something was violative of the First Amendment, certainly looking to a federal case that established that would necessarily mean that it also violates the Wisconsin Constitution. But this court has, in the same at the same time that it says we look to the federal Establishment Clause, continues to recognize that our state constitution is less flexible. So the fact that something arguably passes muster under the First Amendment, which we do not believe that this program does not necessitate the conclusion that it is permissible under Article 1, Section 18. And I think that's particularly important where the argument is that the federal test is changing. The federal test is becoming more permissive of governmental funding of religious activities. So I think while the court certainly can look to the federal cases, those federal cases in no way can limit this court's analysis of our own state constitution. I think one feature of the choice program that makes it inescapable the conclusion that schools get an unconstitutional benefit is the fact that, the fact discussed by the parties earlier, is that most religious schools charge less in tuition than they would receive from the state under the program. We believe that the choice program, even if limited to tuition payments alone, would violate Article 1, Section 18. But the fact that the program does not limit payments to the amount of tuition means that the schools will receive more from the state than they would receive from the parents if the parents were paying out of pocket. And who receives the benefit when the state pays in excess of tuition? Not the parents or students. Payment of tuition alone would suffice to allow them to attend the school. It is the private schools and the religious organizations that sponsor them that are the direct and substantial beneficiaries of payments in excess of tuition. The schools, because they are getting more than they would from the parents, and the sponsoring churches, because they are relieved of the responsibility for subsidizing the difference between tuition and costs.
How does that square with the Atwood case, which was a 1919 case, which this state said, as I understand it, that returning World War I veterans could attend any nonprofit college, vocational school, high school, or elementary school in the state, including religious schools? We're talking about the benefit. And although that was not, I would say that there was not a great deal of reasoning in that case, but how does that square with your statement?
I certainly concur that there was virtually no analysis of Article 1, Section 18, nor was the language even mentioned. I would have several points to make about Atwood. First, this court has never relied on Atwood as precedent for Article 1, Section 18.
Well, Atwood has never been overruled. It's still law, right?
It has never been expressly overruled. It is the principle that it purportedly establishes that reimbursement of costs is permissible has been rejected in cases such as Reynolds, in cases such as the Marquette Dental School case. This court's modern jurisprudence clearly rejects the notion that reimbursement of costs is permissible under Article 1, Section 18. And I see my time is up, but then I may finish answering Justice Wilcox's question. The statute in Atwood was very different than the statute we're talking about here in terms of the cost. The statute, as the court pointed out in the Atwood decision, very clearly limited the state's payment to the incremental cost or the marginal cost that the school would incur in taking on a student. That may be very small. For example, if a school has, say, 500 students, and the average cost per pupil of educating those students is $3,000, the incremental cost to that school of taking on one more student or 10 more students is minuscule. The choice program statute, on the other hand, provides that the cost that the state will pay will be the average cost averaged across the entire student body. So that it is not just a small marginal cost that's being paid. Judge Robinsack, in her dissent, suggested that the choice statute could be read to provide to the schools just that marginal cost. I think the majority correctly responded that it is not what the statute says, and it is not an appropriate judicial function to rewrite this statute.
And is there an audit that would show that, so that if the state's giving more money, it would get it back? That's not part of the statute.
Well, in the DPI emergency rules, which were in effect for the past school year, while the non-religious aspects of the amended program went into effect, have various auditing and financial statement requirements that the school have to schools have to comply with, and it prescribes the means by which the schools allocate all their costs, which are both the direct costs and the debt service costs related to educational programming, and divided by the number of students. So, yes, the DPI has prescribed procedures for doing that.
Any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Castle.
Thank you.
Mr. Hall?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. I, along with Attorney William Lynch, represent the NAACP in this matter. We will address the respondent's claim that amended MPCP violates Article 10 of the Wisconsin Constitution. We will also speak to the NAACP's claim that amended MPCP violates the equal protection clauses of the Wisconsin and the United States Constitution. The respondent's position is that amended MPCP violates both Section 1 and Section 3 of Article 10, the education article of the Wisconsin Constitution. It is clear that both of these sections of Article 10 were intended to provide a state educational system which is free, uniform, void of sectarian instruction, and which includes certain accountability and oversight requirements by providing for a supervisory role by a state superintendent of public instruction and for local control by a district. Under amended MPCP, the authority and the ability of the superintendent of public instruction to monitor, evaluate, and supervise instruction going on in participating schools, as contemplated under Article 10, is sharply curtailed. Involvement and supervision of public instruction by a state superintendent is important to protecting the rights and interests of parents and students, particularly minority students. In the past, the state superintendent was petitioned with respect to allegations of discrimination in Milwaukee public schools on behalf of minority parents and students in Milwaukee public schools. With respect to Article 10, Section 3, it is obvious that with regard to students participating in MPCP, parents are deprived of participation in accountability and oversight where they no longer have a say in electing school boards. It deprives the public of a voice in the operation of schools they support with tax dollars. This fact situation before the court today is distinguishable from the fact situation which was before the court in Davis versus Grover. In that situation, there was a small number of students who could transfer, who could attend the choice schools, 1,000 students, non-secular education. The court even said in its ruling that the kids attending the choice school could return, choice schools could return to the public schools if they so desired. Indeed, that may have been the case with a small number of students, such as 1,000 students. But where you have a program now where up to 15,000 students could attend schools under the program, it's questionable, it's unlikely, improbable, in fact, that those kids could return to the public schools. It's not like the public school system would just have 15,000 seats sitting there waiting for them. So therefore, the ability of the public school system to accommodate the students of the district and provide and present them with a uniform education is greatly different than it was before Davis. Also, to have up to $50,000 possibly drained from the public school system deprives the public schools of having those monies and resources and therefore being able to continue to provide a program, a uniform education program for the remaining schools in the district. The type of education offered by the private schools is general education, K through 12, the type of education that's contemplated under Article 10, Section 3. It's not supplemental, separate, supplemental or special ed. It's the type of education that makes it such that these schools should be district schools as contemplated under Article 10, Section 3.
Mr. Hall, didn't the court in Davis versus Grover find that private schools were not district schools? Do you think that changes just because of the numbers?
Yes, Your Honor. We think that simply saying that they are private schools, simply calling them private schools, does not meet the requirement of Article 10, Section 3, which essentially provides that it provides for a certain type of education that the state is required to offer and that's required to be offered in district schools. If state funding is being used to provide that type of general education, then indeed these schools should be district schools. So simply calling them private schools is part of the violation.
So the numbers really do make a difference.
The numbers do make a difference, Your Honor. If I may... One of the primary purposes of Article 10 is to secure for all students of Wisconsin equal education opportunity. The NAACP does not agree with the proponents of amended MPCP that the purpose and effect will be to improve educational opportunities for minorities. We believe the effect will be segregative and it will not improve educational opportunities. The NAACP filed a claim.
What do you think it will do?
We think it will have a segregative impact, Your Honor. We think it will lower, we think that the answer to this is, the uniformity provision is part of the answer. To the extent that resources are drained from the public school system, it will diminish the public school system's ability to provide a uniform quality education to the remaining schools in the district. In addition, we think it will be segregative because under the program, many of the schools that apply for subsidies are largely one-race schools. They are schools that are much less integrated than the schools of Milwaukee Public Schools. We think the impact will be segregative, and that's our equal protection claim.
What will be the two tracks? Who will be in the, I assume by two tracks, well, I guess two tracks is my terminology, but there will be two tracks, I guess is what you're saying.
Yes, Your Honor.
Who will be in the better track?
Well, there would be some students who attend private schools and the dollars flow from the public school system with those students, and there would be a large number...
Are you saying that those would not be minority students?
Well,
students that choose under the definition for public school choice?
Well, even if they... Well...
I'm just trying to track what it is you're trying to advocate for Justice Babbage's question is what...
Well, in terms of equal education opportunity, the private schools who apply for and are eligible for subsidies aren't required to educate special ed students, students with learning disabilities, many of the students that the Milwaukee Public Schools are still required to educate. So the students...
But you argued segregation. And what is your segregating who from...
Well, in terms of the racial segregation, the schools that apply are largely one-race schools. There are many schools that are being created now that are all black schools that apply for these subsidies. And so these funds are going to finance and support those schools as well as schools that are largely all white schools.
And can't the parents control that to agree by their choice of where they're going to send the students?
But the schools sign up for the program, therefore for making themselves eligible to participate, they then receive the subsidies.
Only if the parent says so.
Yes, but Your Honor, still to the extent that the parents choose to send their children to these largely one-race schools is akin to the constitutional violations that were found to affect the academies that were created following Brown versus Board when one-way schools were created there and were struck financing those schools or having funds go to them was found unconstitutional.
Are the racial makeups of the schools found in the appendix somewhere?
Yes, it is, Your Honor.
And what is the percentage of schools that you're saying are one race, namely white schools, that signed up for the school choice?
There's a listing school. It's listed in the appendix. I just know that they are much more one race school. They are largely segregated as compared to the schools in Milwaukee.
Segregated in the sense that they are white schools or they are primarily African-American?
In the sense that some of the schools are essentially all black schools. Some of the schools are schools that are very, a very high percentage of the students are white.
Mr. Hall, do I remember your briefs correctly that you indicated that there really had not been much discovery on this issue and therefore there was not much proof that could be offered in support of your position?
Yes, Your Honor, that is correct in the sense that we filed an equal protection claim. The circuit court bifurcated the claim and decided that in the event that the plaintiff respondents did not prevail on one of the other claims, the NAACP should have a right to try to put on evidence and have a trial on the equal protection issue. And that's the Court of Appeals upheld that position, and that's what we are asking this court to do, or
so
to recognize.
On your claim, in other words, you'd like the opportunity to be able to go back and develop proof. Is that correct?
Correct. Your Honor, we strongly believe that the amended program should be struck down on the grounds that are being argued before the court today. But we are simply saying that in the event that it is not, we would request that right.
Well, could you be a little more precise for me, please, Mr. Hall? What precisely would you seek to prove?
We would, with the equal protection claim, Your Honor, we would seek to prove that as a result of the violation of the Wisconsin... Equal protection is being denied to a large group of students in Milwaukee, primarily minority students. We think that that's happening as a result of the violation of the Uniformity Clause. The Uniformity Clause is designed to provide uniform education.
But before you mentioned handicapped children with special needs, is that part of the aspect of proof that you believe you could develop a case that children with special needs, those needs are not being met as a result of this law?
Oh yes, Your Honor. We think we could develop that because we could show that to the extent that monies are drained from the moved from the public school system to these schools. Let's say if it's $55 million. These schools then are not educating, they are not required to, and it's in the appendix materials with regard to the students they take and don't take. It will show that many of them don't accept the hard to educate students who are left in the public school system to be educated. The Milwaukee public schools, therefore, are left with the hardest to educate students with depleted resources that are going to the private schools. So, therefore, the public schools are less able to provide a quality educational program to the, say, 85,000 students that it will be left to educate, who will be the essentially, including students with the learning disabilities and so forth that we refer to, it is mandated to educate.
Doesn't the state give extra money for such students to the schools for disabilities? They don't give them the same amount of money as children who are easily educable. I'm sure they must give them a greater amount for each one of those students.
But Your Honor, but to the extent that resources are drained from the public schools...
What is the budget totally of the Milwaukee public school system?
I don't have the new budget figure in.
Because I'd like to compare 50,000 to something, because you keep...
50 million.
50 million.
Right.
You keep arguing about that's going to drain tremendously the public education.
Your Honor, it's a tremendous drain. Further, if Milwaukee public schools were required as... is contemplated, I assume, by the argument that if these students wanted to return to the Milwaukee public schools, it would be required to spend additional funds just warehousing and maintaining classrooms to allow these students to return should they want to return. I mean, there are all sorts of, it essentially sets up a competing school system where Article 10, Section 3 is designed to have a school system of general education.
Thank you, Mr. Hall.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Chairman, and a welcome to you, too.
Thank you. Good afternoon. As Mr. Castle indicated, my assignment is to explain to you in the next few minutes why the amended choice plan violates the establishment clause of the First Amendment to the United States Constitution. As some of you may recall, that was my assignment on February 22, 1996, and I previously appeared before this court in this case. My argument is basically the same. As far as the First Amendment is concerned, the justices of this court, with all due respect, are not free agents. You are bound by the decision of the United States Supreme Court in the Nyquist case, and under that decision, you have no option but to hold the choice plan unconstitutional. Now, personally, I think I made a terrific argument last time I was here.
That's why we remember you, sir.
Well, I think you were one of the ones who I think may have thought I made a terrific argument. But unfortunately, I fell short. At the very least, I failed to persuade Justices Steinmetz, Wilcox, and Geske. Now, rather than repeat my prior argument, I would like to pick up where I left off and explain to you why certain things that have happened in the interim support my position.
Counsel, I didn't have the advantage of your argument 2 years ago, so I'm not encouraging you to repeat all of it, but if you want to summarize it, that would be fine.
You may be in better shape than your colleagues. In response to my 1996 argument, the petitioners pointed out that Nyquist was at that time 25 years old. As Chief Justice Abrahamson and I went through the colloquy on oldies but goodies, it was 25 years old. And they contended that it was more appropriate to be guided instead by what they termed the Supreme Court's more modern Establishment Clause jurisprudence, as reflected in such cases as Mueller, Witters, Zobrist, and Rosenberger, which according to petitioners indicate that Nyquist is no longer good law. I am happy to report that the definitive rejection of that contention was provided by the United States Supreme Court itself on June 23, 1997, when the court decided Agostini versus Felton, a decision which for some reason that continues to elude me, petitioners believe supports their position. In Agostini, the Supreme Court overruled its 1985 decision in Aguilar v. Felton, involving the providing of Title I services in parochial schools in New York City, and it overruled part of its 1985 decision in the companion case of Grand Rapids versus Ball. By the time the Agostini case reached the court, there had been far more than vague indications about the continued validity of Aguilar. Indeed, five justices had expressly stated in other cases that Aguilar was no longer good law and should be overruled. Despite those statements, in the Agostini case, the United States District Court applied Agostini, applied Aguilar, and on the basis of Aguilar, ruled against the plaintiffs. The Second Circuit Court of Appeals, despite those statements by the Supreme Court justices, was bound and did apply Aguilar, and on that basis, ruled against the plaintiffs. And most importantly, the Supreme Court made it clear that the District Court and the Court of Appeals had done precisely what they were required to do. It reiterated the black letter principle of law that the court reserves to itself the right to overrule its prior decisions. Petitioners concede that Nyquist has not been overruled. And this court, like the lower courts in Aguilar, are bound to apply Nyquist. Even if you believe that the U.S. Supreme Court might decide the case differently if it came before it today. But there is also a substantive message that emerges from Agostini. In Agostini, the court allowed New York City to send public school teachers who remained under the authority of public authorities into sectarian private schools, and on the premises of those schools to provide secular, remedial, supplementary services pursuant to certain specific safeguards, which included, among others, no religious symbols in the classroom. The Title I materials and supplies could only be used for the Title I program. There could be no interactions between the Title I teachers and the private school teachers, and no money could go into the general coffers of the private school. The teaching of Agostini, Your Honors, is this. Look to the specific terms of the plan that is before you. The constrained New York City Title I program, with the indicated safeguards, is far removed from the amended choice plan, which involves the unrestricted payment of money to pervasively sectarian private schools that can be used by those schools to pay salaries of employees affiliated with the religious mission, to purchase religious materials, and to pay for religious education and other religious activities. But Agostini, I submit to you, is significant not only for what the Supreme Court overruled, but for what it failed to overrule. As noted, it only reversed part of its 1985 decision in Grand Rapids versus Ball. Grand Rapids involved two separate programs, and the court left standing its 1985 holding that the Grand Rapids Community Education Program, which, like the amended choice program, used sectarian school teachers, not public school teachers, to deliver services on the premises of the private schools.
The court held this violates the Establishment Clause, even though the services there in the Grand Rapids program were purely secular. Now, petitioners point out that the Grand Rapids Community Education Program was not specifically before the Supreme Court in Agostini, and that is true. But of course, the Grand Rapids Shared Time Program, which it struck down, was not before the court either. And we would have to be exceedingly naive to believe that this Supreme Court would not have reached out to the Grand Rapids Community Education Program if it believed that its 1985 holding was no longer good law. Let me note that in an opinion issued by the Attorney General on December 15, 1997, the Wisconsin Attorney General, he reads Agostini precisely the way I have indicated. After laying out all of the safeguards that were built into the New York City program, he states, failure to strictly comply with the letter and spirit of those safeguards would almost certainly run afoul of both the federal and state constitutional provisions. What he in effect has said is that the amended choice plan, which departs totally from those safeguards, both spirit and letter, is unconstitutional. In the few minutes that I have left, I would like to totally shift gears. I have been involved with the amended choice plan for almost 3 years. I have invested endless hours in research and analysis and have argued before the Wisconsin courts on 3 separate occasions. Barring review by the United States Supreme Court, this is my last hurrah. And with the indulgence of the court, I would like to take a moment of what might be termed personal privilege. Throughout this litigation, we have been portrayed as the bad guys, as uncaring, as insensitive to the needs and aspirations of disadvantaged minority children, that we are attempting, for some unstated but surely unworthy motive, to deny to them this golden opportunity to escape from the jungle of urban education. We have refrained from responding in kind because we are attorneys. We believe that our job is simply to argue the law and not to debate policy. But quite frankly, we resent the role in which petitioners have cast us. We are fully aware of the educational problems that exist in cities such as Milwaukee and Cleveland and other urban centers. Indeed, in at least some cities in this country, the term crisis is probably not an overstatement. But these problems cannot be solved by schemes that skim off 5,000 or 10,000 or even 15,000 students from highly motivated families and leave behind 85,000 or 90,000 or 95 other students based on the dubious theory that competition with a relative handful of private schools coupled with fewer resources somehow will produce a dramatic turnaround in public education. Every child, not just a chosen few thousand, is entitled to a quality education. And that goal can be achieved not by abandoning public education, but only by working within the system, by using innovative techniques like site-based management and mentoring and bringing about the necessary improvements. But my point, Your Honors, is this. Even if I believed otherwise and considered voucher programs to be a viable solution to the problems of urban education, I would not change my legal argument, because to do so would be a disservice to this court, to my profession, and to our system of laws. Our challenge is not to solve the problems of urban education in any way possible. Our challenge is to solve those problems with solutions that comport with fundamental constitutional principles. I am dismayed by crime in the streets, and by the fact that I can no longer walk safely in Washington, D.C. That, too, is a crisis. and I am sure that it would help the situation if all suspected criminals were rounded up and summarily hauled off to jail. But I adamantly oppose any solution that would solve the crisis of crime in the streets by compromising our constitutional commitment to protect the due process rights of every suspected criminal. Petitioners from the outset of this litigation have emphasized the alleged educational crisis that exists in Milwaukee, as if that somehow provides a reason to loosen constitutional restraints. But they have it precisely backwards. The existence of a crisis, whether it be in the schools of Milwaukee or in the streets of Washington, does not provide a reason for bending or ignoring or looking for ways around constitutional principles. To the contrary, it is in times of crisis that our commitment to these principles is tested. During his argument 2 years ago, Judge Starr stated that he supported the amended choice program because he had looked into the eyes of the children who benefit from the program. I submit to you that that is a profoundly disturbing statement. It is precisely when we look into the eyes of the children and our emotions push us to simply do what we think is good for them that we must adhere most rigorously to our fundamental principles, such as the separation of church and state. Because if we compromise these principles to solve a crisis in the short run, we pay a terrible price in the long run. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Shannon. We have a rebuttal. Mr. Lefkowitz.
Thank you, Your Honor. And I'd like to reserve a couple minutes at the very end for Mr. Bullock. The ACLU, to begin with the state religion clause, is asking this court to ignore 30 years, indeed, really 100 years, of this court's precedent in favor of a reading of Article 1, Section 18 that simply doesn't square with those cases. In Reuter, in Nussbaum 2, in Lindner, we start out by looking to the Wisconsin Constitution, and it is this court's precedents that direct us to also look at the Establishment Clause primary effects test. It is not we who are saying ignore this state's precedents. On the contrary, we think that this court should look at its Atwood precedent, which was not overruled by Reynolds, which was not overruled by Nussbaum 1. Neither of those two cases dealt with statutes that were neutral. Atwood with a neutral statute. Indeed, they say mere reimbursement is not aid has been overturned. In Nussbaum 2, there was a great deal of reimbursement to the parochial schools. That was not overturned. Indeed, Your Honor, we are not asking this court to do anything other than what the court has always said it will do. Look at its own constitution, look at its own jurisprudence under Article 1, Section 18, as informed by the Establishment Clause federal primary effects test, which this court has always said, despite the change in the language, despite the difference in the words that Justice Cassidy talked about in his concurring opinion, it is not so prohibitive so as not to encompass the federal primary effects test. Now, the MTEA plaintiffs talk about Nyquist, and they say, we insist that you have to overrule Nyquist. That is not true at all, Your Honor. We nowhere say in our briefs that you should or even that you have the authority, with great respect, to overrule a precedent of the Supreme Court. What the Supreme Court made clear in Agostini is that if a lower court finds that a Supreme Court precedent is indistinguishable and therefore controlling, what is appropriate is to affirm or to treat the Supreme Court precedent as the precedent and to leave it for the Supreme Court to then conduct the review, not to try to overrule a Supreme Court precedent. However, Your Honor, I do not believe that you need to reach Nyquist directly because Nyquist is not a controlling case. Nyquist is a multifaceted program designed particularly, indeed, the court said, and the Supreme Court has gone back to the language many times, the intended, the desired effect of Nyquist was to, in effect, bail out the parochial schools in New York State, not to deal with a crisis in parochial school education, not a perceived crisis in public school education. Indeed, Nyquist included a direct cash grant program. It also included tax deductions in which certain parents were able to actually get a greater deduction than indeed their cost of tuition would be, thereby not just being made whole, being put on equal footing, but actually getting an incentive. This is not, the Milwaukee Choice Plan is not an ingenious plan for channeling aid to religious institutions. It is, first and foremost, a plan about expanding opportunities. Now, what is important about Agostini, beyond the holding that obviously only the Supreme Court can reverse its own opinions, is the fact that Agostini wraps up all of the primary effects jurisprudence, and indeed, although Nyquist wasn't before it, just like the other portion of Ball was not before it, so therefore it didn't address them directly, what Agostini does is it explains how going all the way back to Everson, the first of the modern Establishment Clause cases, what the Supreme Court has been concerned about with first and foremost is neutrality. But neutrality, the court says, is not enough on its own, because we also have to make sure that there are not direct payments. And so, citing to Mueller, and of course Mueller with a case with 96% of the benefits, and they went into the many, many millions of dollars, and citing to Zobrist and Witters, where it was pervasively sectarian education, what the court said is, when we have those types of programs, then we know that it is truly a neutral program. The benefit is not intended. The primary effect, or in fact, as the Nyquist court said, the desired effect is not to benefit religious institutions. So, Your Honor, as I would conclude to give a minute to my co-counsel, with a proper respect for the presumption of constitutionality, I think the program here meets the standards under this court's own jurisprudence and, of course, under the federal primary effects test.
Thank you.
Mr. Lefkowitz, if I might ask you a question. Do you feel that Agostini basically adopts and utilizes yet again the Lemon test or the Chilton test? Do you see any distinctions between Agostini and those tests?
Well, Your Honor, I would suggest that the Supreme Court, while never having in any way overruled Lemon, one of those cases where exactly it hasn't come up, they haven't overruled it, but they have moved away, and indeed, as this court recognized, I believe, just last year in a case called LLN, what the court focuses on, the Supreme Court focuses on in the Establishment Clause context, is no longer the different prongs of Lemon, but the basic element of neutrality. And in effect, what that really has done is it's recognized that the first two prongs of Lemon, in effect, really get collapsed into what is the true effect of a program. And of course, as I would suggest, Your Honor, there really is, in a sense, a confluence between the Benefits Clause under Article 1, Section 18, and the Establishment Clause, because they really do, in light of the Supreme Court's recent primary effects jurisprudence, focus on the same harm. The issue is, make sure there isn't a real benefit to religion. But if a program is neutral, then of course, and of course if it's indirect, to make sure that the money only flows by virtue of private actors. To take Justice Babbage's example, it is not a matter of my giving a check to Justice Abramson and asking her to give it directly to Justice Babbage. It's giving a check to Justice Abramson and saying, you can dispense with it to any of the justices on the court.
All right, counsel, I have one question, and that I've been just waiting here to ask the state, particularly having heard the arguments, doesn't the plan, as it currently stands, compel the taxpayers of the state of Wisconsin to put money into parochial / religious schools that they otherwise would not be compelled to support? In other words, that's under Article 1, you know, Section 18.
Your Honor, the only cited case on the compelled support issue is Weiss. And Weiss was a very different kind of case. Weiss was a case where a particular public school, the Edgerton Public School, was in effect commandeered. It was a public school that in its entirety had been supported or erected by public taxpayer funds. And And by requiring the reading of the King James Version of the Bible, it was in effect a preference for one sect of religion, one sect of Christianity that adopted that reading as opposed to a different sect. The only other area where this court has addressed compelled support doctrine is in the Halt case, a unanimous decision in 1975, where this court rejected a compelled support claim because, of course, the court said nobody is being compelled to actually engage in any religious activity. So I think if we look at those two lines of cases for compelled support, it's clear that this case does not run afoul of the compelled support doctrine any more than it runs afoul of Article 1, Section 18.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much.
Three very brief points. One of my co-counsel scolded me, Chief Justice Abrahamson, for not making clear on the funding that is at risk, that the payments are quarterly in 25% installments. So that is the maximum exposure if a school were to close down. To Mr. Hall, who was the only person on the other side to address the non-religion issues, Mr. Hall's equal protection claims, as Justice Crooks, I think, pointed out, are not before this court. But I would emphatically say that the interests of the people that he purports to raise concerns about are represented in this courtroom. They are not represented on that side of the table, however, but on this side of the table. 97% of the kids in this program are black or Hispanic. They have made the choice to take advantage of
special education.
I don't know, Justice Babbage. I don't know that there are statistics there. However, and this actually relates to a point that Justice Steinmetz raised, and this was actually a point that came up in the original litigation in 1990 in the trial court. The Individuals with Disabilities Education Act guarantees at the federal level a free, appropriate education for every disabled child in America. If a child chooses to go to the choice school in the private school choice program, under that law, it is very clear that the services that that child needs follow that child. This is federal money. It's a federal program. That child loses nothing by going to the choice program, expands choices for those children just like anyone else. The school is not required, just as individual public schools are not required to adopt every possible special accommodation, but the school district that receives the funds remains obligated to make sure that that child receives a free, appropriate education, and the funding follows the child. A final point with regard to Mr. Channon's comments.
I'm still not clear. These schools, under the law, do not have to accept those children, do they?
The school, actually, the program is silent on that issue. The school must accept by random selection any child that applies for the school. Presumably, a parent would not apply to a school that does not have a program that is commensurate with that child's special needs. However, under the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, the case law holds, if a parent says, I've got my child in the public school, I think Urban Day School provides a better academic education, but that school doesn't have an interpreter for my child who happens to be blind. Urban Day School doesn't get the money under IDEA, nor does it, as a result, get the responsibility to provide that interpreter. The school district still gets that money, and if the child needs an interpreter, the school district still provides that. So even for disabled children, and just like a public school, a specific public school does not have to accept a specific disabled student. Under the law, the district is required to provide a free appropriate education, but it doesn't have to be in every single setting. So again, under that law, this program does not constrict choices, it only expands them. A final point on Mr. Channon, who was recounting his 3 years, he is but an infant compared to the 8 years that I have spent in this litigation from the very, very beginning. And the reflective point that I would like to leave this court on is that we are bound by the constitutional claims that were raised by the plaintiffs, but that does not mean that there are not other constitutional guarantees that impact this case. And most notably, the guarantee to every child of an equal educational opportunity. And it is to that promise that this program is dedicated. And I thank you very much.
Well, thank you, and I'll remind you all that Colette has dealt with these issues for 150 years. Celebration of our sesquicentennial. So with that, we conclude the hearing on 970270, and we're in recess until 9:45 tomorrow morning.